Welcome everyone
Everyone.
to a slightly echoey first few seconds of our regular Wednesday Clear Mountain live stream. Today we're lucky enough to be joined by Dr. Eben Alexander, who Steve Wilhelm connected us with. And Dr. Alexander, if we may read your bio and introduce you.
Very good.
Dr. Eben Alexander is currently best known as the New York Times bestselling author of Proof of Heaven, A Neurosurgeon's Journey into the Afterlife. Other books include The Map of Heaven, How Science, Religion, and Ordinary People Are Proving the Afterlife, and his most recent co-authored with Karen Newell, Living in a Mindful Universe, A Neurosurgeon's Journey into the Heart of Consciousness. His books are available in translation in over 35 countries. Dr. Alexander was an academic neurosurgeon for 25 years, including 15 years at the Brigham Women's Hospital. And more. He authored and many papers and made over 200 presentations at conferences and medical centers around the world. In that time, he personally dealt with hundreds of patients suffering from severe alterations in their levels of consciousness due to trauma, etc. He thought he had a very good idea of how the brain generates consciousness, mind, and spirit. Then, as discussed in Proof of Heaven, in the pre-dawn hours of November 10th, he was driven into a coma by a rare and mysterious bacterial meningitis, encephalitis of unknown cause. He spent a week in a coma on a ventilator, his prospects for survival diminishing rapidly. On the seventh day, to the surprise of everyone, he started to awaken. Memories of his earthly life had been completely deleted inside of the coma. Yet he awoke with memories of a fantastic odyssey deep into another realm. So since his near-death experience, Dr. Alexander has been reconciling his rich spiritual experiences with quantum physics, cosmology, and the philosophy of mind. His teachings worldwide include education about the primacy of consciousness and the vital practice of achieving expanded states of awareness to fully express our higher soul's free will, including extraordinary healing. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Eben Alexander. And that's a good bio. I'm sorry if I condensed any of it, but
That covers all we need to know. Talk about it all.
It was, we so appreciate you joining us, Eben, truly.
Well, my pleasure. It's a real honor to be with you tonight, and I appreciate the invitation.
So people can feel free to type questions into the chat. We'll have a chance at the end of the session to ask what people would like. But just to begin with, Dr. Alexander, would you walk us through the near-death experience that served as the basis for your book, Proof of Heaven, as well as the circumstances surrounding it that made it particularly interesting to the scientific community?
Okay, absolutely. Well, everything had been going, swimmingly normally in my life up until 4:30 in the morning that November 10th of 2008. So this is about 15 and a half years ago when it all happened. And it began with severe back pain, headache, and then grand mal seizures. And I was gone from this world. There's a misperception out there due to some poor reporting that this was a medically induced coma. It was not. It was induced by the meningitis. And that's a very important fact to know to kind of start making sense of it all. And it's really valuable because meningitis is such a perfect model of human death. It destroys the human part of the brain, the neocortex, the whole outer surface. And that's what I was going through that morning, although I had no idea how severe it was going to get. But I was rendered comatose and having seizures before I ever left my house. And my family called 911, and I was hustled off to the emergency room. I don't know anything of the next week from my own personal experience. I was gone from this world until, 7 days later when I started coming out of coma. But important to point out, one of the atypical features of my coma was that I was amnesic. I had no memory of Eben Alexander's life. I had no language, no knowledge of Earth, this universe. It really was an empty slate. And don't worry, that's very rare in NDEs to have that kind of amnesia. But I think it was absolutely critical for me to get some of the deepest lessons of the journey. Because in fact, that amnesia persisted throughout the week of coma, and only started to lighten up when I came back to this world, even though initially, when I woke up in the ICU room, I didn't even recognize my mother, my sisters, my son. So that tells you that amnesia was still very active. But words, language, and personal memories came back rapidly over hours and days when I first came back, and all memories came back within about 2 months or so, all my semantic knowledge, etc. And the memories were even more complete when they came back than they had been before coma. We discussed that a little bit more in our third book, Living in a Mindful Universe. But let me tell you about the journey. The journey was an amazing thing. And again, this is a journey that, according to all the tenets of modern neuroscience and its belief in the role of the brain in creating consciousness, was impossible. And yet it all happened. And that, to me, is a gift, a tremendous mystery. It began in what I call the earthworm's eye view, a very primitive, coarse, unresponsive realm. But I was ushered up through a kind of a musical portal of light into the next level, which I call the Gateway Valley. Gateway Valley was much more real than this world. People often think that, you know, an NDE would be murky and dreamlike. This world is murky and dreamlike. That world, that spiritual realm, is absolutely sharp, crystal clear, memorable, detailed, transformational. I mean, it's an extraordinary mode of knowing, because it's completely outside of our space and time. I mean, this Gateway Valley that I'm talking about, that's where people would have life reviews. And your life review, birth, death, everything in between, simultaneously presented, relived from the perspective of all involved. That's an interesting thing about life reviews. I couldn't have an Eben Alexander life review because of my amnesia, but I saw life reviews and reincarnation very strongly in some of the visions I had as this journey progressed. Now, in the Gateway Valley, many Earth-like features. Was a speck of awareness on a butterfly wing, millions of other butterflies looping and spiraling in vast formations. I never had any body awareness at all. I was just aware of what was going on around me. Most beautiful gift of all this was I wasn't alone. There was a lovely young woman, sparkling blue eyes, high cheekbones, high forehead, broad smile. She looked at me with a look of pure love, and she never said a word. She didn't have to, but her truth was delivered telepathically to me. You are deeply loved and cherished forever. You have nothing to fear. You are richly cared for. And that was kind of setting the stage for this beautiful journey that was unfolding. Now, given my amnesia, there came a point in this journey in that Gateway Valley where I had what I experienced as a soft summer breeze, as I described it. But in many ways, it was a divine wind. It was a breath of God. It was my first awareness of this infinitely loving force at the very core of this universe that's the source of our very conscious awareness. Now, in this valley below, there were thousands of beings, and I call them souls between lives. There was dancing, joy, merriment, angelic choirs above providing chants and anthems, hymns that would thunder through my awareness. And it was all in this kind of glorious setting of pure, unconditional love, an ocean of love. And I remember witnessing all of this. And then seeing that those angelic choirs above were providing yet another light portal up to another level, and all of four-dimensional space-time, I could sense that material world down below, and that was collapsing. And then all of the spiritual realm that had a different ordering of causality that I call deep time or meta time, that allows for this kind of simultaneous presentation of your whole life, past lives, and even future possibilities for life. And all of that collapsed down. And I ascended through this an additional light portal provided by the music of those angelic choirs until all of the universe throughout all of eternity was there as a complex oversphere for teaching me the lessons that I was to be taught. And then I was in what I call the core realm. The core was an infinite inky blackness, but filled to overflowing with this ocean of unconditional love, that God force of pure creativity that was so refreshing. It's our spiritual home. The words may sound foreign to you now, but there were thousands of people who read the book Proof of Heaven and reached out to me because it reminded them of some deep journey that they had that maybe they'd even forgotten most of the elements of, but my words were able to kind of conjure up in them those memories. And in the core realm, I was told, you're not here to stay. You'll be going back and teach you many things. And that's where so many of these lessons appeared. It turns out I would tumble back down spontaneously to that earth or my view by remembering the musical notes, the melody. I could conjure up these light portals to come back up the same ways, always reassured by that beautiful guardian angel, always returning to the core. And I'll mention one vision in particular in the core that was very instructive. It's what I call the Indra's net vision. And in this vision, I saw all these interwoven threads, and they represented our lifetimes. And in fact, I could see the very weave of the thread as showing us our incarnation and then between lives, and incarnation between lives. It was a very natural process, but in this beautiful tapestry that I was watching, where I could witness individual life reviews and all the events people went through, souls went through in their maturation, going through multiple incarnations, all in this process of moving towards the oneness with the divine, and this incredible process of spiritual enlightenment. There was this golden center in this Ender's Net vision that, in my view, when I came back to this world and was trying to make sense of it all and start to reconstruct my worldview, I thought it was very much like Pierre Teilhard de Chardin's view of the phenomenon of man and this kind of evolution towards a higher consciousness that he had discussed in that mid-20th century book. And that's exactly what I was witnessing, was a multi-thousand year journey of all of sentience, certainly the part in our planet, although this is something going on throughout the cosmos, many sentient civilizations that are contributing to this kind of expansion and deeper understanding and growth. It takes us outside of our normal concepts of space and time and knowledge and of just the progression of history on Earth, because we have what I see is a paradigm shift here, a tremendous revolution in human thinking that is coming from these kinds of experiences. Now, it turns out I would cycle through all these levels multiple times. Of course, to really go into it all would take days to really discuss every bit of what was discovered there. That's why I've written several books about the whole thing, and I continue to meditate on a daily basis in the process of cultivating further relationships with all that I first encountered in that NDE. But when it first happened, ultimately, multiple cycles through these levels, but then as they told me, you're not here to stay, that angelic choir leading up to the core realm was no longer there. And then I saw thousands of beings going off around me in the distance, heads bowed, many holding candles. And I sensed this murmuring energy that I later called the power of prayer. And that's what was drawing me back to this world. And the final things I saw in my journey, six faces that bubbled up out of the muck. They were very important. They served as what are called veridical time anchors to prove that the vast majority of the spiritual journey had to happen between days 1 and 4 or 1 and 5 of my 7-day coma. That timing is all discussed in the books, but it was a very important kind of concept to get that. And it was really the sixth face that I saw, the last face, that drove me back to this world. This whole journey with my amnesia, witnessing all this, learning all that I did about kind of the bigger vision of the universe without having to rely on the specifics of Eben Alexander's life to tell that story. But now what I witnessed was this 10-year-old boy in my face. And it turns out that this was day 7 of coma, Sunday morning. They'd held a family conference where the doctor said I'd gone from a 10% chance of survival down to 2% with this E. coli bacterial meningoencephalitis, extremely rare in adults, but very deadly. And the doctors recommended stopping the antibiotics and taking me off the ventilator. That's how dire my neurologic situation was at that point. And it was soon thereafter I started to wake up, open my eyes, fight the ventilator. They pulled out the breathing tube, and I said, thank you. I don't remember that. In fact, I don't remember much of the next 36 hours where I was in and out of a paranoid, delusional, psychotic nightmare. But in retrospect, the deep coma journey and the spiritual elements of that journey are as sharp and clear today as if the whole thing happened yesterday. And yet that kind of paranoid, psychotic nightmare when I was emerging from coma, all those memories disappeared within weeks. I'm glad I wrote them all down, but the whole assembly plus the 15 and a half years since then to work with scientists and other experiencers around the world to make sense of all this has been very beneficial. Basically, it's completely flipped my worldview 180 degrees from materialism to realizing that consciousness is fundamental in the universe, form of idealism or panentheism. And that it's all through the binding force of love, and that we're all interconnected through that realm of mind. And that, I think, is what is most important about this lesson. So now we can kind of discuss any other ramifications or questions you might have about it all.
Yeah, thank you very much. There's obviously so much there and so much overlap with Buddhist practice, and specifically with some of the earliest teachings of Buddhism. One of the teachings in the Pali Canon is about mundane right view, and a lot of that is around, you know, the efficacy of generosity and the truth of future lives and past lives and the truth of karma. And the last one that's mentioned there isn't really talked about much, but it's that there are contemplatives and Brahmins, spiritual seekers, who rightly faring, practicing rightly, proclaim this world and the next after having directly known and realized it for themselves. And typically that's framed as being, you know, people who've attained enlightenment. But I feel like your voice is really, it's powerful to hear. And I'm curious if you could speak about your own motivation for sharing and perhaps about any other stories in a similar vein that you've encountered that have had a transformative effect on you.
Well, I think it's important to point out the healing nature of the story, healing, coming into wholeness. Because in so many ways, I came to realize that what we're doing here as human beings is trying to grow into the souls we came here to be. We have goals, and those goals can be beyond our kind of ego acknowledged goals, and have to do much more with what I call our higher soul. And to me, I think that's one of the biggest gifts of this entire revolution in understanding. And from my perspective, it really begins with the near-death experience as the tip of the spear. And the near-death experience is, by and large, more than 90% of people who have these experiences come back knowing that there is some uniting force of love and compassion and mercy at the core of the universe. And it doesn't matter what you want to call that. In fact, I came back, as I say in the book, I called it that deity Om, because Om to me had less baggage. I had grown up in a Methodist church. I thought the word God had plenty of baggage. But I realized coming back here that it doesn't matter if you want to use the word God, Allah, Brahman, Vishnu, Jehovah, Yahweh, Great Spirit. There are many terms we use, but that ultimately, especially when you focus this through the lens of NDEs across all cultures, across all belief systems, you start to get a kind of a commonality of unification of mind and the binding force of love that makes it crystal clear, especially through those life reviews. I mean, life reviews happen in 25 to 50% of NDEs. The life review is very noteworthy when you study large series of them, because they are reliving the events, not just remembering. And not only that, it's done from the perspective of all involved. So in essence, the life review is like the golden rule: treat others as you would like to be treated, written into the very fabric of the universe. And I think this is a very important concept, and it you can really kind of expand on this thinking, especially when you move beyond near-death experiences, because they are only the beginning. And certainly, in my books, especially in the third book, Living in a Mindful Universe, we really start taking information from multiple lines of inquiry, the neuroscience and what's called the hard problem of consciousness, which is really an impossible problem for materialist science. There's no way to connect the dots from the electronic fluxes and chemical reactions in the brain to phenomenal experience and our kind of entire mental world. It just doesn't work. And that's especially obvious when you start looking at philosophy of mind and the binding problem, the apparent unity of consciousness in an individual, which defies the materialist model of multiple neuronal populations contributing, like visual systems, olfactory systems, hearing, et cetera, all somehow being blended together into this one consciousness, because it's unified from the beginning, at the get-go, in all of us. There are the occasional cases of dissociation, but they only help us to more prove readily how our consciousness is such a profound kind of ingredient of our existence. And then you take quantum physics, which for more than a century has been screaming at us that consciousness is primary. And of course, that Nobel Prize in 2022 for entanglement is really referring to the mental field of connection, the same thing that we use for telepathy, for information gathering and remote viewing. And then you have all these other host of parapsychological events that and their non-local consciousness, like telepathy and remote viewing, but also near death and then related shared death experiences, which are just like near death, but happen in perfectly healthy people, usually a relative who could be 1,000 miles away, but they go through the same process as the soul that's departing this world. And so ultimately, for me, the healing nature is the most important, because in medicine, we know mind over matter is a very important principle. I mean, that's what placebo effect's all about. But then you can move on to spontaneous remission. For example, at noetic.org, the Noetic Sciences website, you can find information on spontaneous remission in 3,500 cases published in the 1990s, where they went far beyond any medical intervention for cancer, infection, et cetera, to get healing. And then, as I mentioned, my case, which has been supported by a peer-reviewed journal article in the Journal of Nervous and Mental Disease, September 2018, where they made the point that my brain was in no shape to have any kind of dream or hallucination. And also, when challenged by the peer-reviewed editors of the journal, how do you explain this unprecedented recovery of his? The three doctors who wrote the report, who were not involved in my care, but fascinated by my recovery, said it's because he had a near-death experience. Other similar cases, for example, Anita Morjani, Hindu, who had a beautiful NDE with a loving God that allowed her to come back with full healing and resolution of her advanced lymphoma. Or Dr. Mary C. Neal, orthopedic surgeon who wrote the book To Heaven and Back, had a over 30-minute warm water drowning, kayaking in Chile in the late 1990s, brought to the surface dead, but she ended up making a full recovery. She also had a profound near-death experience. I'm simply pointing out, by acknowledgement of our spiritual nature, our interconnectedness with that infinitely loving force at the core of our very consciousness, it enables us to bring a much grander form of healing into our lives. This is all about recognizing the ego voice is not who we are. I love how Michael Singer, in his book, The Untethered Soul, calls that voice in your head your annoying roommate. This is all about, you can acknowledge that annoying roommate, but don't take it too seriously. And remember, there's a much richer part of you that is connected with the universe at large, with this God force, and certainly with all of our fellow beings, and that we're all really in this together. So,
well, Evan, I'm curious. I mean, the portrait that you paint there of in Proof of Heaven, and just in your description now, it's very optimistic. And I'm curious about maybe the other side of things. Like, part of that right view that I was describing is also there is fruit and result of good and bad action. And you do talk in your life review about, you know, how everyone, if someone's a mass murderer, a serial killer, that they'll experience not only the pain of the people that they killed, but the people around the person that they killed, et cetera. Right. But I'm curious, like, what about proof of hell? Like, what, I could see someone, coming away with the view that, it sounds perhaps like Evan is saying that everyone's going to go to heaven. So,
Well, no, let's put it this way. The life review is a very important concept. And for example, Hitler's life review, he would have to experience all of the death, 53 million dead in World War II, others who knew about that later, everyone who knows the Holocaust. So I don't believe there's an eternal hell, but I do believe that we are responsible for the choices we make in life. And that's why it's important to treat our fellow souls with love and respect and kindness and mercy, to take care of the least, the last, and the lost. I mean, it's really a pretty simple lesson, but it has to do with the fact that we're spiritual beings in a spiritual universe. And by spiritual, I simply mean we're interconnected in that mental phenomenal space, and that we have shared meaning and purpose. But to me, it makes no sense to think that you can mistreat others and then expect the universe to ignore that. And that's why the life review is such an important concept, but it also serves as a course correction. And that is, in the setting of our loved ones who have left the physical plane, who can participate in our life review, and then we plan next incarnations. but it's always towards grace. I think this is an important point to make. The view that I have of reincarnation as it applies to near-death experiences and to, you know, sentient beings, humans going through this thing we call life, is that it is very much about a process of growth, transformation. Referring back to that book of Pierre Teilhard de Chardin, The Phenomenon of Man, he was talking about an evolution of consciousness itself throughout the cosmos. And I think that's what's happening. And what we find, you could almost call the life review to be kind of a neutral ground. You know, if you handed out tons of pain and suffering to others, then you receive it in the life review. But if that doesn't bother you, then you're good. But it turns out most of us, you know, if we've been handing out a lot of pain and suffering to others, been greedy and selfish, you know, that doesn't feel so good to the other people around us. And I think that's where the life review is so valuable. And I came back from my journey realizing that in many ways, the hardships and difficulties in life are gifts. I came back realizing that people who I thought were difficult, you know, my nemesis, somebody who was trying to prevent me from getting things in life, that in some deep way, we were near and dear soul mates. We were just trying to teach each other especially challenging lessons. It reminds me of that statement of Confucius, and I'll just be paraphrasing here, but he said, if you find something objectionable in another, look inside yourself. And so for me, there was a beautiful kind of component in this reflective nature of this experience that showed me that, you know, we all need to treat each other with this kind of love and respect as the divine and sacred beings we are, because this is how the world can progress most effectively. And if we continue with this false sense of separation that's so inherent in materialist thought, you know, scientific materialism here, a physicalism, you know, the notion that only the physical world exists and that we must somehow just identify with these bodies that exist birth to death, you know, that can get very confusing. And when we see ourselves through this larger lens, as a soul that's involved in the actual evolution of all of consciousness throughout the cosmos, you know, it starts to become a much more bigger and more interesting mission. But ultimately, from our perspective right now, it's really about healing, coming into wholeness. And I would say that any physical, mental, or emotional healing is ultimately spiritual in nature, meaning it has to do with reconciling and coming to resolution of the sense of connectedness with our fellow beings, and that we're responsible for all of our thoughts and actions. And the more they can reflect that unconditional love at the core of the universe that is the essence of that God force that so many near-death experiences have come to admit is very real from their experience, this is where we can really grow as individuals. And the good news is you don't have to have an NDE to get all this. Meditation, centering prayer, going within, exploring that mental realm, and ultimately that spiritual realm is greatly beneficial to any and of all of us. And just to put it out there, as you know from reading the book, I do meditate on a regular basis, an hour to a day when I can, more if possible. I use binaural beat brainwave entrainment, and anybody who's interested in that tool can go to sacredacoustics.com to learn more. But really, any tool you have that enables you to take that little voice in the head, the ego mind, acknowledge that it is just this tiniest little speck of you, and that, in fact, it's often responsible for the toxic, you know, addictive and all that kind of thing. So the ego is not your friend in the spiritual journey, but it is part of who we are. But to kind of expand our awareness of self to this higher being and through meditation and centering prayer, I think is very valuable.
Eben, I beginning just want to thank you for sharing like this experience with the world. And I know that takes some courage because it certainly risks a career at the current, you know, climate. And, you know, I think we can overlook how meaningfully your experience overlays onto Buddhist thought. The life review, you know, is very much commensurate with karma. In the Tibetan Book of the Dead, they speak about encountering a mirror. Just the whole concept of reincarnation or rebirth is, you know, it's just so spelled out in such detail in Buddhist thought. So I find a lot of faith when I hear you speak about these things. And what one thing I am wanted to kind of steer into is you came from a dry materialist secular worldview, and many of the people listening to this have a similar worldview. And you know, the fact that you're a doctor and have looked into the research around these things, you live near the University of Virginia's Division of Perceptual Studies, I think would be a really important part of your identity or knowledge base to maybe lean into a bit. So I wondered, for someone who's watching this video and might think your experience was the result of an oxygen deprived brain, or that much of the research is affected with self, you know, affirmation bias, would you be able to lay out three or four studies or case studies or meta studies which you found especially compelling?
Yeah, well, actually, I'll give you a resource with 29 excellent essays that prove the reality from a scientific perspective of the afterlife. Go to bigelowinstitute.org. I can tell you that I've received more support from the scientific community than from just about any other quarter. Mm-hmm. So do not believe that my story is one of kind of woo-woo nonsense and anti-science spiritualism. It is actually right at the juncture of the intersection of science and spirituality in the modern era. Turns out quantum physics absolutely doesn't just allow for the reality of a mental universe and the importance of that phenomenal spiritual mental realm, but it demands it. And that is that we discuss all that in Living in a Mindful Universe. Division of Perceptual Studies, as you pointed out, if people go to uvadops.org, there's a tremendous amount of information there supporting the reality of non-local consciousness. That's what we're talking about. The brain is a filter, and the primacy of this thing we call mind in the universe at large. It turns out all the physical world depends entirely on that spiritual mental realm for its expression. You know, as Pascal Jordan said, we not only, the mind creates the emerging reality. And this kind of statement has been made by many of the leaders in quantum physics. And it turns out that when you follow the history of quantum physics coming right up to the current era, including that 2022 Nobel Prize for entanglement, this is really all about the scientific understanding of the mind-brain relationship. And it turns out in our book, Living in a Mindful Universe, we use neuroscience, philosophy of mind, non-local consciousness, many examples of telepathy, remote viewing, et cetera, near-death, shared-death experiences. But one of the most important arms of this body of data is that reincarnation data that comes from University of Virginia is one resource. Carol Bauman, James Matlock have also been very key scientific investigators into past life memories in children, suggestive reincarnation. But the group at UVA since the 1960s has now studied more than 2,200 cases of reports of past life memories in children suggestive of reincarnation. Many of those were before the internet back in the 70s and 80s. And of those 2,200 cases, more than 1,700 have been solved. That is, they actually found the person who lived before. Now, you might say, I don't remember past lives, so I don't believe reincarnation is real. Well, as Jim Tucker and Ian Stevenson will tell you, you must harvest these memories from the children before age 6 or 7, because they're natural processes that cover them over. So that we don't, I guess, with this stage of human development and with our kind of cultural beliefs and limitations, that's kind of the state of where humans are now, that we have to have this kind of skin in the game by having programmed forgetting of those past life memories that happens late in our early childhood. And yet, when you read this literature from serious scientists investigating these cases, and a lot of the more recent cases are from, the Western world. There's a really beautiful story that's been vetted by Jim Tucker. It's in a book called Soul Survivor, S-O-U-L Survivor. It's about a World War II fighter pilot who died in the Battle of Iwo Jima in March 1945, but then is reincarnated as a young boy in Louisiana in April of 1998. It's a beautiful story. I highly recommend it. As I said, this one's been vetted. It has a lot of fascinating details. And once you start getting this literature, you realize we just live in a much bigger universe than I might have thought before when I was studying, you know, my materialist science and neuroscience and trying to explain how brain creates consciousness. I was missing that there's a tremendous amount of information, especially in the form of human experiences, that tell us that, you know, the brain does not create consciousness. Consciousness is much grander than that. And it is unified. We're all part of this primordial mind. It's the argument we go to in our Living in a Mindful Universe. I know that in Pim van Lommel, he's a Dutch cardiologist who's written extensively about NDEs and about consciousness. He won second place in that BigelowInstitute.org essay contest. And towards the end of it, he starts moving towards the one mind hypothesis, which I think is where all of science is headed. Understanding how the brain works as a filter to give us this little eddy current of consciousness, but then how it is released back into this incredible ocean of consciousness at the time of bodily death. And yet there seems to be what I call viscosity that preserves the soul line, the kind of history and memories between lives, so that we can, as an individual soul, go through progressive lifetimes in this process of refinement and growing towards the oneness of the divine. So, you know, for those out there with a secular mind who want to believe they're physical beings and it's birth to death and nothing more, all I can tell you is the evidence completely defies that point of view and absolutely supports the scientific reality of the afterlife. Start reading some of those essays at BigelowInstitute.org. Bernardo Castrips is especially scientific. He appeals to no paranormal phenomena whatsoever, but just to quantum physics and logic, and points out the reality of the afterlife. Pim van Lommel's Jeffrey Mishlov's winning essay is absolutely extraordinary. But you'll realize this is no longer a question of whether or not the afterlife is real from a scientific perspective. It is. These essays answer that in the affirmative. And so if anyone comes to you and tells you as a scientist that they don't believe in the afterlife, they're simply telling you they haven't read or studied any of the relevant material, and so they remain willfully ignorant. But the material is there. There's no excuse not to go there if you have a serious interest in this question. But go to BigelowInstitute.org and you will learn a lot more.
Something, thank you, Evan. Something I like about your writing is that a lot of it's just very beautiful. I mean, as I was saying, there's a lot of, you're describing things which you describe in these very early texts, and specifically the way you talk about the spaciousness and the apparent boundaries are part of the supreme illusion that the world out there is actually out there. That's a quote, and that really melds quite well with meditations on space and consciousness. One thing which you described really beautifully and you touched on earlier is when you were kind of descending, and there are these beings who have their heads bowed, and speaking about that as being, you were feeling that was actually the prayers of other people. And this is something which comes up in cultural Buddhism, is somewhat touched upon in the early text, but is something which is hard for, you know, a dry materialist, or certainly that's how I was raised. I like Buddhist ideas, but yeah, I don't have personal experience of a lot of them. So if you could say more about that, that experience of this.
Absolutely. Excellent question. I mean, if we think about what's happening to someone, what they're describing when they're having near-death experience, when their body is trying to die and their brain is going offline, it's an opening expansion of awareness. It's a, you know, it gets much grander. It doesn't get limited and restricted. And so, for example, when you read these accounts, you find people are connecting with loved ones who can be at a great distance, who might be coming there. For example, Anil Morjani talks about her brother who was on a plane flying from India to Hong Kong, you know, supposedly for her funeral when she was in the dying process. And she had this perfect mind meld with him. Many other accounts, similar kind of expression of mind expanding, and especially reflected in shared death experiences where a loved one could be 1,000 miles away. Say the mother is dying in Massachusetts, and as she's dying, her soul goes and gets to the mind of her daughter living, say, in North Carolina, and the two souls go off, even to the point where the daughter's soul witnesses a full-blown life review of the mother, and then her soul comes back to this world. And I've met many people who have told me directly those shared death experiences, not just near death. But also, of course, a huge part of the dying experience described in NDEs is connecting with the souls of departed loved ones. In fact, if you read Gregory Shushan's work, he studied NDEs in primitive and aboriginal cultures. And he says the most common ingredient in NDEs in these primitive cultures is the loved ones who have passed coming to escort us over. Now, of course, before my coma as a card-toting materialist neurosurgeon, I would have told you that's wishful thinking. But I now have heard many examples of cases where people had kind of information that was passed to them in that kind of setting, in a deathbed vision, after-death communication, something like that, that could only be in the now to help them in that moment. So it's not just wishful thinking. In fact, I've come to realize that when people, especially those who are say, comatose as they approach death, they often have what's called terminal lucidity or paradoxical lucidity, where they come back to life, usually within hours or a day or so of dying, and can have brilliant kind of memory and interaction with loved ones at the bedside then and there, right here in the material realm, before they pass from this world, you know, usually with a beautiful smile and a very peaceful transition. So all of these phenomena, when you start to study them, they start to paint a much bigger picture of our souls and interconnectedness of souls. That's important. That binding force of love is so crucial to explaining all of this. And I would simply add that by realizing that this is not just a bunch of anecdotes, but that scientists have studied these, and then when you assemble multiple categories of data, as we do in Living in a Mindful Universe, or as you will find in the BigelowInstitute.org essays, that it all starts to make much more sense. But we just need a much bigger theater of operations to explain it all. And ultimately, the evidence is showing us that consciousness is primordial and unified. And we share that. And that's why meditation and centering prayer can be so valuable. I figured out within 2 years of my coma, after reading 150 books on quantum physics, spiritual traditions, East and West, what have you, that the only way to really get some deep answers about my near-death experiences was to explore consciousness. And that has been the best move of my life. I know from our workshops that people who have never had an NDE can come to tremendous knowledge about all of this through meditative experience. And that's why I'm such a big proponent of meditation, promote sacredacoustics.com and all the beautiful work they do, because binaural beats are a way of using sound, influencing the lower brainstem to give us a tremendous liberation of conscious awareness, on our attempts to meditation. And that is freeing consciousness away from this kind of limitation of the false belief of self and of the here and now, because we have access to all of space and time as we explore those conscious realms. And this, of course, is where we can also start to wield influence on our emerging reality and on the pathway that the future takes. And that's one of the reasons I am so optimistic in the current era, in spite of all of the kind of negative polarization in politics and the media and all the bleak headlines and warfare. What I see is a paradigm shift in the scientific community that is being fueled because of the humans having these experiences. They're very common, and people no longer accept the nonsensical, answers of materialism that pretend it's all just a hallucination, because that does not match the data. And this much bigger world, much more kind of impressive ability of our souls and interconnectedness of our souls and impressive kind of nature of love and unconditional love and helping to bring healing and wholeness to our world. These are tremendous gifts, and that's exactly what we're talking about. That is this revolution and awakening. Ultimately, I would say at least 5,000 years of human effort at understanding the nature of reality is bundled into where we're going right now. And interestingly enough, the scientific truth of the unity of consciousness emerging from all this blends beautifully with Buddhism and with other spiritual traditions going back thousands of years. They were right. And now science can prove that. And that's actually what is occurring here. But it's not materialist science. You find gaps in the materialist science. For I'll give a quick example of that. If you study, say, the psychological effects of serotonin 2A entheogens, psychedelics like psilocybin, magic mushrooms, LSD, DMT. Now, I do not promote those for casual use. I believe meditation is a much better way to get these spiritual truths, but it's important that the research is now being done with psychedelics. Especially one of the hallmarks of those studies is if you use functional MRI, magnetoencephalography, to look at the brain of people under the influence of those substances, what you find is the brain is going dark. You know, people who take them would think, oh my gosh, my brain must be lighting up like a Christmas tree. That's the opposite of what's happening. Your brain is going dark. So as a neuroscientist, if you want to study, you know, the phenomenal effects of entheogenic substances like psilocybin, don't be going to neuroscience and what's going on in the brain. You have to move beyond that. The brain is simply getting out of the way. I saw that full force in meningitis when I saw all lobes of my brain impacted by a E. coli infection. And that damage is what allowed this robust, incredible expansion of conscious awareness. So it's really to get to the depths of consciousness, you end up having to kind of turn the brain off, get it out of the way. And that's what those substances do. But we can also do that with meditation. And that's where I think especially the dynamics of sacred acoustics and what it's doing in the lower brainstem by altering a very important circuit that then modulates the kind of 40 cycles per second ignition signal being sent up from the lower brainstem. That's where it allows us to liberate conscious awareness and be freed up from the here and now and sense of self.
Eben, thank you so much for taking this time. It's significantly later for you. We do want to paste the Zoom link into the chat for those who want to move on to Zoom right now, where we'll continue this conversation for about 45 minutes, and want to especially encourage anyone from the International Association of Near-Death Studies, who are some of whom are joining us, to jump on there. But if Ajahn Kovilo goes off and hosts that, Eben, can we steal you for another 10 minutes?
Sure, let's do that. Nice.
So thank you, Ajahn. Yeah. Great to meet you.
Very good to see you too.
So Evan, I wanted just to make sure that our audience got a chance to ask a few questions. So if this could be, I think we'll do a rapid fire round, if that's
all right. I'll try to be quick with my answers, or efficient, I should say.
All right. So Jessica, what are a few of the main ways this NDE has changed the way you choose to live your life?
It's much more one of love, a sense of responsibility that I have to my fellow beings and to myself. And I realized when I came back that it's not that we don't love our enemies and our neighbors enough, that we don't even love ourselves enough. So a tremendous kind of refocusing of my life on love as a healing force and spreading that message as best I can. So it's flipped me 180 degrees from that materialist, physicalist worldview to one of idealism or panentheism. Panentheism being the notion that the unifying God force is in all of us. In fact, the entire universe is within that consciousness itself. So it's been a tremendous gift in many ways.
Did you ever have a choice to stay at a particular level? Moving through, did you have a willful momentum?
Well, I think, you know, it's interesting. When I look back on it, I really felt for most of that journey like I was being showed around. Not that I had a tremendous amount of free will of higher soul to kind of guide the way. And it's kind of interesting, but I think it was definitely kind of higher soul and God force that were conducting this kind of journey that I was going through. And it was really my free will was mostly important at the very end. When I was decided to come back. And that's when those six faces were so important, especially that of my son Bond, who was pleading with me, Daddy, you're going to be okay. Daddy, you're going to be okay. I didn't understand the words. I didn't know who he was, but I sensed this really deep connection. And even though because of my amnesia, most of the journey, I could think this can continue, cease, doesn't matter. But when I saw his face and that sense of pleading, and I assure you, I did not see him with my eyes. My eyes were like that, neither pupil working, my ears. I didn't hear him with my ears. I was far gone from this world. But But that perception that he was pleading with me to be there for him, that's what drew me back to this world, this incredible sense of love. And of course, it obviously was not lost on me that his name that we'd given him 10 years earlier was Bond, because he turned out to be my bond to this world, to this cosmos.
After all these beautiful angelic experiences, do you think all of the defilements were removed, or are they still there?
I think that it's a work in progress, that I am still journeying. I use a tremendous amount of prayer and meditation, as I said, and I believe I still have a lot to discover about the nature of reality that I think even in this lifetime I will be gifted with. So it's always, you know, in terms of looking back on my past and kind of the life review that I go through in meditation, you know, I'm still making amends and still seeking ways to express that love and to share that unconditional love with all of my fellow beings. And that certainly includes close family and friends.
And I think maybe I'll just ask, I'll get the last one in and then we can let you get some rest, Eben. I'm curious what the, in your life after the NDE, who has been the being you've met or the person you've met, or maybe one or two who've most deeply embodied that love, which you touched briefly during that week in a coma?
My partner, Karen Newell. I met her about 3 years after my coma. Anybody who's read Living in a Mindful Universe, she was a co-author of that book. I found her to be a beautiful, rich, spiritual mentor with a tremendous amount of love and understanding. It also comes packaged with a brutal honesty. But, I think true open-minded skepticism is one of the best gifts in this journey. But we really need to open our minds to even begin to encompass the kind of depth and breadth of this kind of discovery about the nature of reality that is right there in all of us. And but I'm very grateful to Karen and all that she has brought to me in terms of wisdom and a simple sense of peace. She's the co-founder of Sacred Acoustics. She's the voice right there at sacredacoustics.com. Mm-hmm. I would also simply suggest another resource that Karen came up with. It's called innersanctumcenter.com, innersanctumcenter.com. And if you go there, you'll see what I mean. There are many things available. There are interviews we did during the pandemic with thought leaders around the world in these topics. There's a monthly webinar that we do, and also a mental health practitioner course with Dr. Anna Usum, who wrote the paper that supports Sacred Acoustics is offering a 26% reduction in anxiety over 2 weeks. And that paper was published Journal of Nervous Mental Disease in February of 2020. But Karen has been a tremendous blessing in my life, a true godsend and a spiritual partner. It's always.
Oh, I think we may have cut out, Eben. Dr. Alexander, can you hear me? Well, I'm not sure if people are seeing me or you, but regardless, Eben, it was delightful having you on, and just want to appreciate you taking the time with us today. I find it so heartening to actually hear someone's experience of all these realms and have the courage to speak about those experiences. So we hope you get to visit us soon. And please, if you're ever in Seattle, make sure to reach out. Those who would like to join us on Zoom now, the link is in the chat. And additionally, you can find it if you go to clearmountainmonastery.org. You can scroll down the page to the event listing and find the Zoom link there. So we hope to see you all there soon. Okay, take care, everyone. Oh, wait, Evan's back to say goodbye. And then he came back.
Sorry, I think the universe is getting a little tired of my talking, so it turned me off. But anyway, gratitude to all of you for being here this evening. Blessings to you all. And you can reach me through evanalexander.com, sacredacoustics.com, and blessings. Thank you very much for having me on. I appreciate this.
Dr. Alexander, what I was saying to the blank screen or your sort of frozen face was just how much it means to hear your experience and acknowledging kind of the courage it takes to dive into what you did. And just thank you on behalf of our community. And please, if you're ever near Seattle, reach out and we'd love to meet you in person.
Absolutely. I will do that for sure. Thank you so much for having me on. It's great talking with you. And thanks for doing what you do to get this out there.
Great.
Okay, thank you. All right. Have a wonderful evening.